Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dude's perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude and a tired dude.
Yeah, I look like you need some pep pills. You're just doing the West Coast turnaround.
Man, I'll say I've been out on the West Coast for the last 5 days and I'm wore out. Got back in here at 3 a.m. in the morning our time. That was just midnight on the West Coast.
Yeah.
It was 3 a.m. here. A short day.
You're big time now. You're on the Sawbones, Bim Bam, Adventure Zone tour.
Yeah. Touring there with I'm like one of the roadies or something.
You're the roadie?
Yeah. I hear Jackson Brown singing about me. Let the roadies take the stage.
Well, I guess it's not so much of a roadie as more of a babysitter.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't pack them up and tear them down on the stage. I pack up the babies and carry them along.
Pack up the playpens and tear down the playpens?
That's right. Yeah, Mary and I went along and played Grandma and Grandpa and took care of the babies while the boys and girls were performing and everything. Because Sawbones was in that. Sawbones opened for two of the shows. All of them were sold out. They did two shows in Seattle, Sawbones and Mabim Bam one night, and then the Adventure Zone the other night. And then we took the train down to Portland, and while we were in Portland, we did a live show there. Sawbones opened for Mabim Bam again. So,
yeah,
they were all sold out and went very well.
A whirlwind tour.
Yeah.
And you guys got to stay at the lodge where Twin Peaks was filmed, I guess?
Right. Yeah. We stayed at that and saw the... So I'll tell you one thing that really interested me. The whole basis of that getting started was a 23-year-old guy. This was back in the 1800s, of course. Mm-hmm. But he saw this while he was working for the railroad. He saw this area, this waterfall-type area, recognized the potential for it as a hydroelectric facility mm-hmm. back in the late 1800s, got his dad to give him the money so he could build a hydroelectric plant there.
Wow.
How many 23-year-olds these days are ambitious enough to do something like that? I was just amazed at that.
Yeah. It is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then when you were 23, you're pretty much like 50.
You're almost dead, huh?
Yeah.
Pretty much at the end of life. But it was a very interesting trip. I will say this, you know, the boys have a rider for what's backstage before the shows and everything. Mm-hmm. And they asked that there be craft beers from the local breweries put in there.
Right.
In addition to a few other things, but that's one of them. The craft beer selection at Portland I like much better than the craft beer selection in Seattle.
Ooh, really?
Yeah. The Portland beers were, I mean, they were right on.
The Seattle ones were not quite as good?
They were okay. They were all right.
But you don't like IPAs, though.
No, and that was the Seattle ones were heavy in IPAs. They had some stouts and porters in the Portland ones. So yeah. I guess I'm biased in that manner.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly your favorite kind or style
right.
there.
Yeah.
See, I would be in IPA heaven. I like IPAs.
Yeah, but that's what the boys are sitting in. That's what they like. They go for the IPAs.
Well, this episode, we are going to talk about something that's a little, kind of a small little niche of area of law, and it's called the Undertaker Doctrine.
Does it have something to do with that WWE guy?
It does not.
His doctrine is, I will take you down, and you will not get up.
Yeah, I think The Undertaker in the WWE is known for his choke slam, I think, where he basically picks people up by their neck and slams them.
Well, there ought to be a law against that.
The Undertaker Doctrine actually has nothing to do with the WWE wrestling superstar.
Oh, well, now I'm out of answers now.
And it actually has nothing to do with traditionally like an Undertaker, like someone that takes care of the recently deceased either. It's something totally different.
Well, then it makes no sense at all. What, do we just make up a name?
A little bit, but before we get into actually what the Undertaker Doctrine actually is, which started this whole this episode
podcast,
I did go down. When I was researching it. I did go down a bit of a rabbit hole with some strange old Wisconsin case law dealing with undertakers in general. And these are actual real undertakers that you would think.
Oh, okay.
And some of these things I just came across were just, they were too interesting not to talk about, so.
Well, all right, then. We'll bear with you. And your rabbit hole.
There's one case called State X Rel Kempinger v. White. And basically, State X Rel, whenever you see like the X Rel, basically that is a it's an abbreviation of the Latin phrase ex relatione, relation. It means arising out of relation or narration of the relator. So basically, it basically means that procedurally, it means that it relates to something the state has power over. So if you see State X Rel, that doesn't necessarily mean the state is bringing that action. It means it relates to the state. So whenever you see that X Rel thing, kind of a little interesting tidbit there.
All right.
For you legal scholars.
Or you legal brief type people.
There you go. You think that might be on legal briefs?
Probably, and I'll still probably miss it. X Rel.
X Rel. So according to this case, Kempinger v. White, Section 156.01 of the Wisconsin Code, 1919, was held invalid because it required an undertaker to procure an embalmer's license. And it went on to say that the two callings being so vitally different that they cannot be placed under one classification, although it was assumed that both can be suitably regulated. The provision that all persons engaged in the undertaking business on January 1, 1921 should be licensed as embalmers as well was held especially void because based on a classification bearing no regulation to the subject matter. So, for whatever reason...
The state tried to make it so that if you were an undertaker, you also had to be a qualified embalmer?
Yeah, you had to have an embalmer's license and an undertaker's license.
But couldn't you just have a guy that has an embalmer's license on your payroll or something?
Well, I guess, you know, they were basically saying that an undertaker...
You had to do both.
Yeah, you had to do both, because an undertaker, I think, is traditionally like a mortician, essentially. Mm-hmm. So you had to have both licenses yourself. You couldn't, I guess, employ somebody. But they basically said, no, those jobs are totally different. We're not going to make them have both licenses.
Well, I can kind of understand that to a point. I mean, you know, I don't know. In the early days, probably it was a one-guy operation. But as you get bigger and move more into current time, you have somebody that owns it. And you have other people that do the work.
Yeah.
And that's fine to have them certified, but you shouldn't have to have the guy that owns it be certified, too.
Yeah, I just thought it was kind of funny. And then as I was reading about this case, I came across this... this old text, and it had the cite to that, but it also talked about another, I guess, attorney general opinion. And so basically an attorney general opinion is where you, if you have a question about some sort of regulation or some sort of law, you can write the attorney general and ask their opinion on it, and they'll issue these attorney AGO opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess AGO opinion's kind of redundant. It's because attorney general opinion. So
attorney general opinion.
Yeah. But anyway.
They'll issue an AGO.
And this AGO said that one guilty of sodomy is not a person of good moral character, and the State Board of Health may revoke his embalmer's license.
What? Now, is this sodomy while he's on the job?
I don't know.
Or was this in his own personal life?
I don't know. Unfortunately, we'll probably never know. This is just the one little tidbit I found out there while doing research for a really, well, I guess it's almost 100 years ago in Wisconsin.
So I was going to say, what year was that?
Probably, like, it didn't say exactly, but it was about 1920.
So if you've been convicted of sodomy in 1919, do not try to go become
an embalmer.
An embalmer.
In Wisconsin.
Obviously, those two things are tied together.
There may be some update to this case law. I don't know. So we'll have to research that further, possibly. But I just thought that was an interesting tidbit as well.
I wonder if they'd let you be a taxidermist.
Maybe, I don't know.
Just no sheep.
No sheep.
No sheep, Sherlock.
Now, under this the same old text I was reading, there was more stuff that went on here. Actually, not having anything to do with undertakers, but having to do with state licensure, and I thought it was kind of interesting as well. Under Section 158.01 of the Wisconsin Code, which is this follows 156.01 was what dealt with embalmers and undertakers. So, going down the line, 158.01. deals with evidently barbers or hair care. And it said, apprentice or student barbers may be advertised as barbers. However, accepting tips for cutting hair without a barber's license, although no charges are made, is violation of the barber code.
Hmm.
So
the barber code, you can't tip the apprentice.
That's right.
Can you tip his boss and he shares his tips?
It was silent as to that, so I don't know. Yeah. Here's another thing. An apprentice barber is prohibited from conducting a barber shop, even if he employs a master barber holding a Wisconsin license. Hmm. A barber holding a permit may run a shop, and an apprentice holding a permit may work therein. So,
well, all right.
Very, very strict about owning barber shops.
Well, now here's one thing to maybe keep in mind. Is this still back in that 1900 time period?
Yeah.
Well, here's one thing to remember. Barbers in those days didn't just cut hair.
Well, I think by then they probably transitioned to stop being surgeons, though.
I was going to say, they were putting on leeches and giving you tinctures and ointments and all kinds of other stuff for what ails you.
Well, I think these barbers were strictly of the hair care orientation barbers. I don't think these were...
you don't think these were surgical barbers?
No, these were not surgical barbers.
And you know, that's why the pole out front was red and white, right?
Yeah. From the blood,
yeah,
the rags,
yeah. I mean, that's not a joke. That's not a dad joke. That's a true thing. That's why they put that out there.
Another law from back then was that one who is engaged in marceling and otherwise caring for hair of her patrons at their home is an itinerant cosmetician and is required to be licensed as such.
An itinerant cosmetician.
Yes.
Man, that sounds like you like travel around and. In wagons and set up places and run around and cut everybody's hair and leave town before they realize I got a bad haircut or something.
Yeah, and marceling is basically a hairstyling technique which hot curling tongs are used to induce a curl into the hair. It's kind of that old school looking Betty Grable type hair or something
like
that.
Yeah, I see what you mean. The ones that are close cropped and real wavy on top.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's much marceling still going on out there, but... if you do it from home to home, you need to have a license.
Well, definitely. In Wisconsin. Now, cheese, you can make it at your will and leisure. But cutting hair, you better be prepared for that. Because Wisconsin's known for the cheese, so I imagine they're pretty liberal with that.
They are. They have really good cheese. And I love cheese curds. Cheese curds are delicious.
I don't eat cheese curds. There were a lot of those on the menu when we were traveling, but I didn't get any cheese curds.
Really?
No. I can't ever help but think of cheese turds every time I read that, and so it gives me a completely different thought on how they might taste.
Wisconsin is actually home to probably my favorite beer, though.
Yeah?
New Glarus? Spotted Cow.
Never heard of it.
It is delicious. Hmm. And you can't really buy it outside of Wisconsin, I don't think.
Hmm.
So.
Is there a law? Only Wisconsinites can drink it?
No, because I was not a Wisconsinite, but I drank it. But I don't think they sell it outside the state for whatever reason.
Oh, okay. So,
the first time I actually had it, I had an illicit keg of it in Florida.
An illicit keg?
I did, yeah.
It crossed state lines?
Yeah, I think somebody must have just gone up there and bought it and then smuggled it across state lines and put it at their bar.
It had to be somebody that had not previously been convicted of sodomy, probably.
Probably not. Because you probably can't get a license for that if you...
That's right.
Again, not to the Undertaker doctrine, but I'm still sticking with morticians and undertakers here because it kind of piqued my interest. But in order to become a mortician or an undertaker, you generally need to get at least an associate's degree in mortuary science.
Mortuary science?
Yeah.
I never even heard of that. Is that a class you take in college or community college or
it's
something?
It's an actual degree.
An actual degree?
Yeah, and in order to get a license, you have to have some sort of degree, and licensure is required for funeral directors and embalmers. In addition to that, usually people have to have some sort of apprenticeship with it to get hired on. And according to a website, morticians should have compassion as well as good interpersonal business and time management skills. They should also have knowledge of laws and ethics regarding funeral service and preparation.
Well, yeah, I suppose they should.
Yeah.
But you know, the one thing about being an undertaker and embalmer, you probably don't get too many customer complaints.
Probably not firsthand. There may be some family members who might complain a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, they don't count. They're not the true customer.
I don't know. Are they?
What's your Yelp review?
And there's actually a licensing board, I guess, or whatever, the American Board of Funeral Service Education. And they accredit different programs. And unfortunately, there's not any accredited program in West Virginia. So if you're seeking to study the mortuary sciences,
you're going to leave the state.
You're going to have to go out of state.
And then come back with your knowledge of mortuaries, embalming, and funeral directing.
Exactly. Now, the Undertaker's Doctrine actually has nothing to do with burying people or anything like that. So,
So we did go down a rabbit hole.
I did. As happens sometimes, you get on the internet, you start clicking things and go one place, and you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's a little bit interesting, too.
You got to be careful sometimes when you click things looking for things and they come up with something different. Like rabbit hole. If you clicked on rabbit hole, there's no telling what might come up.
Yeah, you don't want to go to rabbithole.com. I don't know what's there, but I wouldn't go there. Or I'd go there with maybe some slight trepidation. So the Undertaker's Doctrine, and this is a Florida doctrine, actually. It has nothing to do with burying people. It relates basically to the responsibility of someone who undertakes by contract or gratuitously to aid one in peril and fails to act as a reasonable man carrying out that aid. So basically, you're undertaking a task. It has nothing to do with being an undertaker. So it's a different kind of meaning of that same word.
Well, that's completely misleading.
Isn't it, though?
It is.
Because you're like, oh, Undertaker's Doctrine. This must relate to morticians.
Yeah. And is Florida the only place that calls it that?
It's the only place I know of. It may be in other places as well. But basically all the case law that we're going to be discussing comes from Florida. So,
Basically what I'm hearing you say is in other states, it's what they call the Good Samaritan laws.
Well, it's a little bit different. It's kind of related to it, but this is Good Samaritan laws are basically related to...
Well, you're undertaking something gratuitously.
Well, but it's more like an emergency type situation. This is almost more like a kind of a quasi-contractual type thing. And I'll give you... you'll see some examples here. So there was one case in 2009. It was Wallace v. Dean. And the plaintiff in that case it was a wrongful death action. And the claim was dismissed with prejudice when she had sued the sheriff of Marion County for the actions of a deputy answering a call to come to the aid of the plaintiff's decedent, who had been found unconscious in her home. The deputies, when asked to do so, failed to call an ambulance and assured the plaintiff and her mother's neighbors that her mother was merely sleeping, despite the fact that they had literally screamed at her and shaken her violently enough to move her across the bed. So basically, there were a couple different issues there, whether or not the sheriff had any duty to act non-negligently as to the plaintiff's decedent, and second, if a duty existed and negligence ensued, did sovereign immunity bar the action?
Duty. You said two duties.
And sovereign immunity is basically a legal theory which protects the government from being sued, essentially. And right. It limits the liability as well. So
what I'm hearing is the deputy showed up and the mother was not dead yet.
Just slightly dead.
Slightly dead. I'm not dead yet. But just slightly dead, and he had no idea what to do. He just said, she's sleeping. She's let her sleep it off. She'll be fine in the morning.
I'm not going to call an ambulance. She's fine.
Yeah, you don't need that.
So basically, the 5th DCA, and this is the District Court of Appeals, and they're the ones, the Intermediate Court of Appeals, not the Supreme Court, because they actually have three levels in Florida. They affirmed the Circuit Court's order of dismissal and said that the deputy's actions were merely passive nonfeasance rather than an act of actual negligence, and at the most, poor judgment. The Supreme Court basically disagreed with that and said, a failure to conform to the standard of care is negligence. Therefore, even if it is due to clumsiness, stupidity, forgetfulness, an excitable temperament, or even sheer ignorance, an honest blunder or mistake that no damage will result may absolve the actor from moral blame, but the harm to others is still as great, and the actor's individual standards must give way in this area of law to those of the public. In other words, society may require a person not to be awkward or a fool.
So all of that being said means the guy did the wrong thing and they should be held liable.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I would think so, too. I mean, it's one thing. I don't know. I mean, that's just way too far off from where they should have been. Why not err on the side of calling an ambulance?
I know.
You know, that makes no sense. Call an ambulance, and then if you don't need one, okay, fine. But at least you had one there just in case. You can't wait around and look. Oh, she's sleeping it off.
Yeah. Just
what an idiot. What a maroon.
Tell you what to do. Go get yourself a cup of warm water and stick her fingers in it.
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
I tried to do that to a friend one time when I was in middle school. The whole, you know, if you get somebody, you know, they'll urinate themselves.
Right. We used to do that at summer camp, and it never worked.
Yeah, it didn't really work. So basically, I just took the water and threw it on the guy's crotch, and so that he thought he would beat himself, and then ran off.
Well, we had made the mistake. We had one guy make the mistake of doing that to someone who was a martial arts trainer And this guy woke up violently when his hand was being handled and just about killed the guy that was trying to do it. So from then on, we didn't think that was a very funny joke to play anymore.
Did he give a judo chop?
A kick, more like it.
Really?
Yeah.
Judo kick.
Took him out from the top bunk.
The Supreme Court kind of explained the Undertaker's doctrine in that case. And they went on to say that, as this court recognized over 60 years ago in Banfield v. Addington, in every situation where a man undertakes to act, he is under an implied legal obligation or duty to act with reasonable care to the end that the person or property of others may not be injured. Voluntarily undertaking to do an act that, if not accomplished with due care, might increase the risk of harm to others, might result in harm to others due to the reliance upon the undertaking confers a duty of reasonable care, because it thereby creates a foreseeable zone of risk. So,
well, I think if they had called an undertaker, he would have made a better decision than that deputy did.
He probably would have. He's like,
This one's not ready for me yet. Quick, get that ambulance.
This one's not ripe.
I can't pick them yet.
The sheriff's agents, by responding to the 911 call, entered the decedent's home and assessed her safety and assured her neighbors and her daughter by phone that she was only asleep and didn't need medical attention. In fact, she was in a diabetic coma and died after being taken to a hospital the next day. The court went on to explain why the liability was here. Where the actor's assistance has put the other in a worse position than he was in before, either because the actual danger of harm to the other has been increased by the partial performance, or because the other, in reliance upon the undertaking, has been induced to forego other opportunities of obtaining assistance, the actor was not free from to discontinue his service where a reasonable man would not do so. He will then be required to exercise reasonable care to terminate his services in such a manner that there is no unreasonable risk of harm to the other, or to continue them until they can be so terminated. So,
So he placed her in greater harm because if she had gone to the hospital that night or whatever, she probably could have been saved, but by letting her stay there till the next day before any action was taken, then she was in worse shape.
Yeah, and he actually increased her risk mm-hmm. by what he did. So, well, then the second question they went on, after talking about, in this case in particular, not relating to the Undertaker's doctrine, to answer the sovereign immunity question, because I'm sure you're dying to know how that panned out.
Absolutely, I want to know about the sovereign immunity.
So basically, the court went to the four-part test, which was contained in Commercial Carrier v. Indian River County, which is a 1979 case, and that test requires at least one negative answer to one of the following four questions. First, does the challenge, act, omission, or decision necessarily involve a basic governmental policy, program, or objective? Second, is the question, act, or omission, or decision essential to the realization or accomplishment of that policy, program, or other objective, as opposed to one which would not change the course or direction of the policy, program, or objective? You follow me here?
No, I'm not following either one of those, but go ahead.
Third, does the act, omission, or decision require the exercise of basic policy evaluation, judgment, or expertise on the part of the governmental agency involved? And finally, does the governmental agency involved possess the requisite constitutional, statutory, or lawful authority to do so or do under the challenged act, omission, or decision? So, based on that four-part test, the court said that clearly a yes answer is required to both the first and the fourth questions, but the court found that as to the second and third questions, that the answer would be decidedly and clearly no. The court reasoned as to the second question that performing a safety check more diligently would not in any way change the course or direction of the policy performing those checks, and the deputies did not have to exercise planning, level, evaluation, or judgment. The court basically stated that based upon our review of these questions, we hold that the alleged actions of the deputies were undertaken within the scope of their employment and were clearly operational in nature. Subjecting the sheriff to responsibility and accountability in this case does not involve judicial scrutiny of any discretionary, quasi-legislative policymaking or planning. Instead, such legal inquiry will merely require the trier of fact to determine, consistent with traditional principles of Florida tort law, whether the deputies should have acted in a manner more consistent with the safety of the decedent. The traditional principles of tort law implicated in this case in no way present a non-justiciable political question.
So what I heard out of that is that it wasn't going to cost the government any more money for them to have made the other decision, and they didn't have to change any policy or change any training or anything like that for them. They just needed people working for them that weren't quite so stupid.
Yeah, pretty much. So
hire smarter employees is what they said.
It's kind of an interesting case because, you know, you win on the Undertaker thing, but then you lose on the other. So.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know. You win on the Undertaker thing? Well, he undertook it. He didn't really win on it. They overturned it. They did on the lower court, but then
upper court. Two issues there. The one issue, the plaintiff won on it, but then with the sovereign immunity, they kind of lost that argument. So,
yeah.
But that means it's a total loss.
That's right.
So,
three strikes, you're out.
There was another case, which is a 2018 case, much more recent. That the case we were talking about was a 2009 case.
2018 is more recent than 2009. In my research, that's what I found.
You are on top of that. This is Muchnick v. Goiman. G-O-I-H-M-A-N.
I'm going to say Muchnick's going to lose this one.
You think?
Just because he's named Muchnick. Muchnick, whatever.
The appellate court held that former tenants could assert a negligence claim against the real estate rental agent. A real estate agent knew a family was looking to rent a high-end apartment because they lived in the same building. So they were trying to find another apartment in the same building.
Like maybe with another bedroom or something like that.
He worked, the real estate agent worked for a real estate brokerage firm, and he approached the family about renting another unit in the same building. And when they were walking through there, there were items that the family wanted repaired, and the agent assured the family they would be addressed prior to the family moving in. The family rented the apartment, and the brokerage firm was listed as the broker for the transaction. So, contractually, you have that link right there.
Mm-hmm.
When the family moved into the unit, the items they wanted repaired were not. And to make matters worse, the family discovered a serious water intrusion and damage problem that resulted in mold getting into the apartment's ventilation system. The family communicated predominantly with the real estate agent regarding the issue, as the owner of the unit lived abroad and the agent lived in the building. So basically, it was an absentee owner. And during a deposition, the father claimed that the agent told him that since he lived in the same building, he would be the go-to guy to address any issues with the apartment and undertake repairs. The issues did not get resolved, which impacted the children's health and safety, and they were forced to terminate the lease early and relocate. So basically, the real estate agent argued that his firm, and not him personally, should have been sued because he was acting in the scope of his employment as a real estate agent while dealing with the family. The appellate court basically said, no, we're not buying that.
Well, the thing is he was the one that made the promises. It wasn't his firm that did. He was the one that did it. We don't know that he ever communicated that to the people he represented. He might have just been trying to keep the check himself.
Yeah.
Whatever the share of the cut was.
The court said just because Goiman, who was the agent, was acting in the scope of his employment when he rented the apartment, promised to fix it, and manage the repairs, doesn't mean that he was shielded from personal liability under all circumstances. Officers or agents of corporations may be individually liable in tort if they commit or participate in a tort, even if their acts are within the course and scope of their employment. All that needs to be alleged is that the agent or officer personally participated in the tort, even if the complaint of action was because of and entirely within the scope of his or her employment. Then, basically, he went on to say, he tried to argue that, since he didn't own the apartment, he didn't owe a duty to the family that was renting the unit to fix and manage the repairs. So you can see where that's kind of a natural argument right there, right?
Yeah. Other than, I mean, if he had negotiated with the owner that you have to fix these or something like that, then the owner failed to, but we don't know that he ever transferred that knowledge over.
Well, and the appellate court basically rejected the argument because of the Undertaker's doctrine. Once the real estate agent volunteered, even if gratuitously, to fix the problems and manage the repairs, he assumed a duty to exercise reasonable care in performing those services.
Well, he didn't do that.
Yeah. So, kind of an interesting one.
Hmm.
So, he was held liable for
that. So, Muchnick won.
Muchnick won. You were right.
No, I was wrong. I said he'd lose, because with a name like Muchnick, he'd have to lose.
Oh, well, see,
I was wrong. Goya lost.
You could have pulled one over on me.
I guessed that wrong. I'm sure somebody would have caught me out there that they would have said if I'd have claimed victory on that. We have an audio recording to prove otherwise.
We do.
Hopefully. Somewhere out there. Hopefully I get this edited and put up.
I see some little bars moving up and down, so I think we're probably good there.
Yeah, better be.
There was another case, too. De La Torre versus Flanagan's Enterprises, Inc., which relied a lot on the Undertaker's Doctrine. Second Restatement of Torts is a learned treatise that sometimes courts and lawyers cite to. Have you ever talked about that before? The Restatement of Torts?
and learned treatise. I know that.
Yeah.
He's like this guy that sits around wearing a robe and carries a staff. And they say, oh, what do you say, oh, learned treatise? And he gives a wise statement of something that has happened in the past.
So basically, the there's a case called, and this was cited too in this Flanagan's case, Massad v. Wilson v. Massad x Rel Wilson v. Granzow. A party host took it upon himself to care for a guest who was drunk and had fallen and suffered a head injury. The host had allegedly gave the guest a prescription painkiller, which worsened the symptoms, and left him alone by the pool where he drowned.
So they killed him.
They applied the Undertaker's doctrine there. Carroll Air Systems v. Greenbaum. A business purchased drinks for an employee while he was entertaining clients. The employee later drove drunk and struck a third party who was injured. The court ruled the employer wasn't protected by Florida's limited dram shop law because although the employer didn't furnish the drinks, it had knowledge, actual or constructive, that the employee was intoxicated and in no condition to drive. Although the employer was not at the meeting, the employer had the ability to control its employees. So these kind of are just distinguishing dram shop type actions, which basically a dram shop action, if you remember from when we had Taylor on the show, relates to
the bartender's responsibility in serving drunk patrons.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, somebody falls from being drunk and hits their head, and you give them a painkiller. Mm-hmm. You don't do that with a head injury.
Well,
you know, you don't give them something like that with a head injury. You need to get checked out.
But the difference being is if, say they did this. Say somebody was drunk and they fell, they hit their head. You give them a painkiller, and then you watch them closely for the next 4 or 5 hours, you know, and then something happens, they have an allergic reaction, they have internal bleeding, whatever, and then they die. You have a much better argument having done that it was maybe reasonable given the circumstances if it was kind of didn't look like a bad injury.
Then that you gave him a pain pill and threw him in the pool.
Yeah. Yeah. Take one of these and go lay in that float over there by the alligators. You'll be fine.
But you've been prescribed pain pills before. What's the first thing that it says on the label with your pain pills?
Take with food.
And do not mix with alcohol. So, yeah. I mean, it doesn't give you an order. It doesn't mean it's okay to take alcohol and then take the pain pill. It's still mixing with alcohol. It's not like you're chasing your pills with alcohol.
That's true.
So right there, that was a poor decision.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're probably, you know, I'm trying to make a bit of an argument for the guy, but, you know, probably giving a pain pill somebody who's drunk is not a good idea to begin with.
No, not a good idea, especially when the bottle's labeled. So, and especially if it's a prescription one.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can't share prescriptions. That's against the law, too.
Yeah, that is. So, the guy was pretty much just an idiot.
Yeah. The guy said, here, take this pill and sleep it off by the swimming pool.
So now the 4th DCA looked at those two cases when they were talking about this Flanagan's case. And Flanagan's is a restaurant in South Florida. It's a chain. I've been to a couple of them.
I thought it sounded like a restaurant.
Yeah. McHoolahan's, Flanagan's, Flingers, Chili's.
Yeah, there was a couple of those we used to go to in Richmond that were similar, that had almost the same name. Kind of like that.
O'Shinigan's, O'Charlie's, whatever.
I don't think O'Charlie's is in there. I think that one stands out on its own.
But anyway, a woman had gone to Flanagan's and had drank several alcoholic beverages one evening in 2011. And after a while, when you drink several alcoholic beverages, she became intoxicated.
That'll happen.
It does happen. Staffers at one point stopped serving alcohol to her, observing that she was drunk, and began serving her water. However, no one on the staff tried to stop her when she left and got to the wheel of her car.
They're probably glad to see her go because they thought she was annoying.
Probably. This was actually despite the fact that the restaurant had a policy in place to stop drunk patrons from driving. It involved taking the patron's keys, calling law enforcement, or ensuring the person had a sober driver. And none of these actions were actually taken in this case. The woman got in her car, left, and was involved in a drunk driving accident, injuring some passengers. And the passengers sued Flanagan's, and they basically were citing to the Undertaker's doctrine. And they basically argued that because the bar had this policy and employees failed to adhere to it, the restaurant should be held liable. They argued the issue was not that the bar served the woman, but that employees failed in the duty they had assumed by way of the restaurant policy. Basically, the trial court nor the appeals court saw it that way, and they said the state does not require establishments to stop people from driving drunk, and those that make efforts to try shouldn't be punished for doing so. It was basically the way it came out. So, although they had this policy in place, they didn't get it held against them because they didn't follow it.
Well, I think that their mistake, though, I mean, I know they got away with it, but I mean, to me, the fact they had a policy that went to that length of detail,
yeah,
that said they would keep you from driving, that was at their own peril that they put that in there. It should have just said, we'll refuse to serve you once we recognize you're drunk.
Well, I think
by them carrying it to that other degree, they didn't really follow their own policy.
No, they didn't. And they kind of opened themselves up a little bit, at least to this argument. But under a public policy argument, the courts are reasoning that, you know what, we probably want restaurants to have policies like this in place. So we're not going to punish them for slipping up a little bit.
And if they don't follow them, we'll just wink, wink and say.
Well, I mean, would you rather have them have a policy in place that works 9 out of 10 times or have them just get rid of it because they're too scared to have it in place because of what might happen? So,
I don't know. I think I'd want them to say, if you put a policy in place, then follow it.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think we should hurt these establishments that do that, though. I'd rather them have it in place and they stop it 9/10 of the time.
What good does it do to have it in place if you don't do it?
What?
What good does it do to have a more stringent policy in place if you're not going to follow it?
Well, what I'm saying is if they have this policy in place and they follow it 9 out of 10 times and stop somebody from driving drunk 9 out of 10 times, but they slip up once and it falls through the cracks, it's better to have that policy in place and have them stop it 9 out of 10 times than to not have a policy in place and somebody drives drunk 10 out of 10 times.
Well, where I saw where the hard time enforcing it is, you would have to get people that work there to say, yes, we knew that she was too drunk to drive. I mean, they could have said, hey, look, we quit serving her. We gave her water. We felt like she had sobered up enough by the time she left, right, that she wasn't a hazard to anybody. And what could you prove any different? That's just their opinion. And you can't measure their opinion as to whether it's true or not.
Well, and that leads down towards more dram shop type litigation.
Right.
And I believe in Florida, the current dram shop law is that if you know the patron is an alcoholic or has some problem like that, yet you continually serve them over and over, like they're regular there, basically, that's when you're open for the dram shop type.
And if you don't know this person, never seen him before.
Yeah, I think.
Then you couldn't get them on that.
Right. So, I mean, I think there is going to be some sort of liability there, but I think the real, as a plaintiff's counsel, the real case you're looking for is that this guy went there every day for the past 10 years and did 5 shots of whiskey and drank 10 beers and then staggered home.
And we've never seen this person before. Well, then why is his nickname Johnny O'Flanagan?
Why is his name engraved on the bar here?
Yeah.
In a gold plaque.
O'Flanagan's Barstool.
Why does it say Customer of the Year?
Shirin Begora.
Customer of the Year. 10 years running.
So. Fallen off this stool many times.
So that's the Undertaker's Doctrine. It's kind of an interesting little area of law, I thought, and actually has nothing to do with Undertakers or Morticians, even though we talked about it to a certain degree, because, I don't know, Undertakers and Morticians, it's kind of an interesting area.
Well, it's very specific to Florida.
Yep.
Well, there's a lot goes on in Florida, as noted by a lot of the articles posted on the Facebook page.
Well, there's the whole Florida man type thing about all the craziness that happens in Florida.
Yeah, it's all right to do nude gardening around your house, apparently.
Yeah.
As long as you're not doing it in a provocative manner. As long as the only thing you're pruning is the roses.
As long as you're not using a post hole digger.
Well, now, I could think of one way to use the Undertaker's, what do you call it, doctrine, and involve the Undertaker.
Does it involve Hell in a Cell?
Hell in a Cell?
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
It's a wrestling event.
Oh, no. It doesn't involve that.
Does it involve the Royal Rumble?
No rumbling.
SummerSlam?
No. It's that you're getting everybody, you're getting a funeral arranged.
Okay.
Because you're the Undertaker. So you're arranging a funeral, and you have a guy that works for you, and you have him go out to direct traffic. Mm-hmm. So that you can get everybody orderly out and around. Well, this guy's never directed traffic before, and you send him out to direct traffic. All those that are driving assume that the guy going out that works with the funeral director knows what he's doing. So they follow his traffic laws, and a serious traffic accident takes place because the guy didn't understand what he was doing, and people get hurt. Now the Undertaker's Doctrine is in place for the Undertaker.
And add to this that the guy who was out there directing traffic had actually been convicted of sodomy and was drinking embalming fluid at Flanagan's before he went out there to direct the
traffic. That's right. He was totally drunk. So now the Undertaker is guilty of the Undertaker's doctrine.
I like it. I can go for it.
He took on the role of traffic coordinator and he didn't know how to do it.
I can see it. You should start writing these test questions for law schools.
Yeah. See, that would cross them up. They say, there's one that it really did have to do with the Undertaker. Now what are we going to do? It does have concern for him.
Well, I think it's going to bring us to
Legal Breeze.
Legal Breeze is the part of the show where we talk about different legal terms. And Tommy, what is the first legal brief question I'm going to ask you?
X-rail.
You're right. What does that mean?
It means pertaining to or has the power of or something like that. The state isn't necessarily behind it, but it involves their concern.
It basically is short for Latin for ex relation, R-E-L-A-T-I-O-N-E. I don't know how you pronounce that. I guess if you're saying it
in rationale.
Relatione.
You sound like the Pope.
Nominus nebiscum. So anyway, yeah, it means relating to is kind of the way I would remember it, because X-Rail, R-E-L, you know, so relating to. But yeah, and you see a lot of times in different kinds of cases, I have a couple of cases that say state X-Rail that relate to suing different people in their position of things they do in the state. So you can just add that for certain cases. The next question is marshaling. What is marshaling?
Oh, that's that wavy hair technique with a curling iron.
It is. It's not really a legal brief, but it was too interesting not to bring up because I didn't know what it was.
And, yeah, there's some of those old-timey actresses that you can look them up and see what their hair looked like for what that is. Because once you showed me that picture, I understood what you were saying. Otherwise, it would be totally foreign.
And if somebody came to their house as an itinerant cosmetologist, they need to have proper licensure in order to marshal someone's hair at their own home.
That's right. You can't perform that unless you're properly licensed to do so.
That's right.
Just pack up your wagon and go.
Pack up your hot curling tongs and get out of here. You're not welcome.
Anybody approach me with hot curling tongs, I'm running.
And then the last one is the Undertaker's Doctrine. Can you explain to me succinctly what is the Undertaker's Doctrine?
That means if you're going to undertake to do something, you better be able to do it and be qualified to do it. Otherwise, you're responsible for it. Whether it was part of your job or whether you were doing it gratuitously, you better complete it correctly.
That's right. One definition I saw, or one way I saw it explained that I really liked, I thought this was pretty clear. Whenever one undertakes to provide a service to others, whether one does so gratuitously or by contract, the individual who undertakes to provide the service, i.e. the undertaker, thereby assumes a duty to act carefully and not to put others at an undue risk of harm.
Duty.
The undertaker is subject to liability if he or she fails to exercise reasonable care, which results in increased harm to the beneficiary, or B, the beneficiary relies upon the undertaker and is harmed as a result. So, and you know, this might not be a different legal theory called the Undertaker's Doctrine in different states, but under a general kind of theory of liability in different states, it kind of makes sense. So even if they don't actually call it the Undertaker's Doctrine in other places, if you do undertake to provide a service to others, you should probably be a bit careful about it and make sure you don't do that, because you could open up yourself to liability.
Well, I think, you know, that's what I saw. It only related to Florida for that doctrine. And it's referred to Good Samaritan laws in other states that kind of cover that. And that's kind of along the same lines. It's like, you shouldn't go try to administer CPR to someone if you've never been trained in CPR.
Yeah.
You know, even though you might want to save their life and you're doing your best, you shouldn't go administer CPR if you don't know how.
Because someone else who actually does know CPR might not come do it because...
Yeah, because they think somebody's already doing it.
You're already mucking it up.
Yeah, and you might make things worse.
Yeah.
Because you haven't examined, you know, the air passage or something first before you did it and
right.
Things like that, you know?
But now I think you're safe if, like, it's one of those things where you're the first on the scene. You have taken CPR in the past, but maybe your licensure has expired, things like that, and you're trying to do whatever you can. Then somebody else comes upon the scene and you say, hey, I really don't know what I'm doing here.
I'm just jumping up and down on his chest and blowing in his mouth.
I stayed
because he's kind of cute.
I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night, and that's about all I got going for me. So,
and the guy shows up. You say, "Do you have a ballpoint pen? I'm going to George Clooney this guy. I got to give him a trach."
Do you know how to do an emergency tracheotomy with a steak knife?
I don't think that's a good idea. You probably would get charged for that.
Yeah, you might.
I don't think that you can run around and do some of these kind of things. So, you know, and I think that I've heard this related to doctors too, is doctors are under no obligation. Like if they witness an accident somewhere, they're just traveling from here to there and they witness an accident, they're under no obligation to go and administer care. But if they do, they need to see it through until other ones there. You can't just go and start and say, "Oh, this is hairier than what I thought. I'm giving up."
Yeah.
You got to keep trying to do the best you can do. And you won't be in trouble for it, but you can't just quit.
Yeah. You know, I'm actually a dermatologist, and this guy's complexion looks good, so
I'm done here. My work is done.
My work here is done. His pores look good.
Yeah. He's going to be the shiniest skinned corpse you've ever seen there at his funeral.
Wait till the embalmer sees him.
Yeah, he'll be happy. Especially the one that was convicted of sodomy.
No, he's no longer licensed.
Oh, that's right.
Take him back.
Yeah.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I am just a dude.
Thanks for listening.